Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. John Leonard for an update on where we are with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he began by presenting a 58-year-old woman from his practice with follicular lymphoma who happened to be treated just 2 weeks after the December ASH meeting, and in fact her therapy was very much influenced by new data that was presented in New Orleans.
This is a woman who was active, very busy with her career, who basically was very healthy and felt a groin node in the 2-centimeter range. And this was ultimately biopsied and was diagnosed as follicular grade 2 lymphoma. She underwent standard staging assessments and was found to have stage 2 disease. Her largest lymph node was 4 centimeters in size. Largely, these lymph nodes were in the abdomen and pelvic area as well as the inguinal area. She was asymptomatic. She had normal laboratory studies, and so by the FLIPI score, she fell into the low-risk category. And really, other than this 2-centimeter palpable lymph node, which was largely removed, she was asymptomatic, and so we decided to watch her.
How did that sit with her?
It took some time. I think, like most people with follicular lymphoma, the idea that you are going to watch somebody and not treat them for their cancer takes some getting used to. And this was somebody who, you know, many people come in to see me and have heard about the concept of watch and wait and say, you know, I've heard about this watch and wait stuff, but there's no way I'm doing it. I want to get treatment. And then if you're able to take the time and really explain to them why watch and wait is a reasonable thing to do in their situation, most of them, in my experience, can come around and understand why that makes sense and there's no real reason to intervene. And so she fell into that group, really ultimately was comfortable with watching and waiting. And one of the funny things is that we ended up watching and waiting her for 2 years until she was about 60. And, you know, it can sometimes be hard to get people to watch and wait if you're inclined to observe them. And then once you start observing them and you think they need treatment, it's often hard to get them to come around to get treatment because they've gotten used to the idea of watch and wait. So it's almost like you're going full circle. But this is somebody we watched. Her lymph nodes were gradually getting bigger. And ultimately, these lymph nodes got to be about 9 centimeters in her abdomen. And so she was in a little, not so much denial, but, you know, really wanted to delay therapy. But I think when they got into that sort of size range and they were palpable on exam and starting to get some symptoms, we felt like it was time to do some treatment. And so my main concern in her was the fact that these areas in her abdomen had gotten significantly bigger. And I had a little bit of a concern for whether or not she had some transformation, which would obviously impact how we chose our therapy. And so in patients like this, I like to get PET scans. I think in follicular lymphoma, this is the one place where a PET scan really can help you. Unless someone has limited stage disease where a PET can be helpful, the more common patient who you're observing for a while or having a relapse and you're concerned about transformation, a PET scan to look at the SUV value can be very, very helpful because the higher SUV values tend to correlate with the presence of a large cell transformation. And so in her, I was reassured to see that this 9-centimeter mass had an SUV of 6.0. And so I was less concerned about transformation. And that really gave us a variety of different treatment options for this woman who clearly needed therapy but was unlikely to have a transformation. And so as I approached her, I think a lot of the discussion was focused on, well, we could give her single-agent rituximab, which people sometimes do, but certainly with the bulky disease, I was less excited that that was going to give her a meaningful and durable response. This is somebody who could get treated with something like RCVP or R-CHOP or an R-fludarabine-containing combination. And so I went around the various different options with her. And, you know, one of the things that came out was she really didn't want to lose her hair. And in somebody with fairly bulky disease, I think my inclination, despite the SUV, might be more towards R-CHOP. But given the lack of evidence of transformation, RCVP was certainly a reasonable possibility that probably a year ago in this situation I would have gone to. And I think what really swayed my thinking was the recent data that came out from the German group that did the randomized trial of CHOP rituximab versus bendamustine rituximab in indolent lymphomas, particularly follicular lymphoma. And so at the end of the day, seeing those data, it seemed to me like giving her bendamustine plus rituximab was something that seemed to be a reasonable option that could be highly effective for her, but also would deal with her concern about avoiding hair loss.
When exactly did you treat her?
She started treatment actually in December, just a couple weeks after the ASH meeting.
So if you had seen her a month before, would you have done the same thing? Or was it that data set really changed your mind?
Yeah, I think, you know, the timing of hearing the data, certainly if this was before those data were available to me, I would have probably given her RCVP in that scenario. So I'm glad. And I tell people one of the advantages of watching and waiting is we get smarter and the things change so quickly. And this is a great example of being able to tell somebody, look, it's a good thing you waited a few months because hopefully we got smarter and came up with an option for you that perhaps you wouldn't have had just a few months ago. Just to let people know of this data, basically the bendamustine-rituximab combination was shown in this patient population to have less toxicity, less hematologic toxicity, no alopecia. It does have a little bit of rash, nausea, and some cytopenias, but actually fewer cytopenias or less significant cytopenias than R-CHOP. And in this study, response rates were high, but PFS was improved in the bendamustine-rituximab compared to CHOP-R. So certainly it suggested that this is at least a comparable, if not better, regimen with less toxicity. And in this lady, she's tolerated it reasonably well. She's had a little bit of nausea, probably more nausea than I would have expected with RCVP. So we are aggressively giving her antiemetics, and I think people who use bendamustine need to keep that in mind. Clinically, we haven't restaged her yet, but clinically on exam had very significant reductions in her lymphadenopathy. So she's very, very pleased.
How do you conceptualize the way this agent works, and what about the dose?
The drug, if you look at its chemical structure, has some features of an alkylating agent and some features chemically of a purine analog. Whether or not it works through either or both or other mechanisms, I think, remains to be seen. Some people have argued that it may not be that different than some of the other standard alkylators that we have available. I think, to me, at the end of the day, it's a chemotherapeutic drug, and regardless of its chemical structure, it seems to work in people that have disease that's resistant to some of our standard treatments, including cyclophosphamide and other alkylating agents. So at the end of the day, whether it's a high-dose alkylator or something else, it really doesn't matter. It works, and I think it fills a very nice clinical niche for our patient population. The dosing of this drug has been quite variable in different studies. Bruce Chesson and some colleagues, I think, have a paper coming out where they've looked at all of the literature and provided some dosing regimens. Like some other drugs, when you give it with rituximab, there is a little bit more hematologic toxicity. It's been used in different dosing levels, both in follicular lymphoma and in CLL. We typically use it, the 90 milligrams per meter squared dosing every 4 weeks, although some of the published data and package insert data suggest that higher doses and a shorter interval can be reasonable. I think the 90 Q28 days is something that is tolerable for most patients and can be highly effective. And in most situations when I use it, that's what I've used.
And of course, you're referring to the 90 milligram per meter squared on day one and two. In what situations right now would you use R-CHOP, if any?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, when you look at follicular lymphoma and the data sets such as the LymphoCare study that are out, certainly R-CHOP is the dominant treatment regimen for follicular lymphoma, even though many would argue that the role of an anthracycline remains unclear. My guess is that part of that is just the nature of practice, that if you see relatively fewer lymphoma patients, it's probably easier to use R-CHOP than a variety of other regimens. I think to some degree, that's something that's good for all of us to use, you know, one regimen more often as opposed to many regimens less often and make mistakes or be less familiar with it. So I think the use of R-CHOP commonly for follicular lymphoma is probably in part due to that reason, which is certainly reasonable. I think that what people have said, and as I think about it in my own patients, I think the issues relating to R-CHOP for follicular lymphoma are such that I probably use R-CHOP and will continue to use R-CHOP where I'm particularly concerned about transformation, because I think the role of bendamustine in the more aggressive subtype. So if this lady had had an SUV of 16 as opposed to 6, I would be more concerned about transformation, and I think I would have pushed her to get the R-CHOP type of regimen. Certainly in older patients, you could argue something less toxic would make sense. I think, you know, where the squeeze is going to be, bendamustine is going to squeeze in there and take over a fair number of the R-CHOP patients that would otherwise get R-CHOP. You could argue, what about RCVP, and would you even use RCVP anymore since bendamustine may be more active since the BR combination is as good or better than R-CHOP? And I think that that's certainly a logical thing. I think the one caveat, particularly in younger patients with respect to bendamustine, is the issue of stem cell toxicity. A substantial number, although actually relatively few across the country, but still, I think a younger patient with follicular lymphoma, you have to say that down the line, you may want to be able to do a stem cell transplant on them, an autologous stem cell transplant. You may need that bone marrow to carry you for, you know, a few decades. And the myelosuppression of bendamustine and its effect of stem cells really is going to take some while to fully sort out. Some of the older German studies really didn't look at that very carefully. It is important to note that this study that I cited, the CHOP-R versus BR regimen, did have a parallel abstract that did look at stem cell collections in this patient population on this study. They seem to be equally successful in collecting stem cells, but I think the data are really small and not very mature at this point. And so I think we will need to have some longer-term data as to what are the marrow suppressive effects of this regimen. And that, to me, is the one thing in the back of my mind that makes me have a little bit of pause in using this in younger patients where stem cell transplant remains significantly on the list.
I think we should also note that in the German study of R-CHOP versus BR, which was presented by Rommel at the past ASH meeting, there were some patients with mantle cell.
Yes, and I think it was a relatively small percentage of the patients, as you'd expect, because mantle cell is less common, but there were somewhere between 40 and 50 mantle cell patients in each arm of the study. And the bottom line is that the efficacy was similar. PFS was actually a little bit better in the BR combination. And so to me, to some degree, the data for using BR is even a little bit stronger than it is in follicular lymphoma, because we know that while CHOP-R can do a good job in follicular lymphoma, at least for an extended period of time in many patients, CHOP-R is pretty lousy for mantle cell lymphoma with median PFS in the 2-year range, give or take. And so you could argue that if you have an older patient, a patient who's not going to get an intensive treatment or stem cell transplant, why would you use R-CHOP for mantle cell lymphoma up front in that older patient population when you have BR that seems to be similar and less toxic? The downside of leaving out R-CHOP, which, you know, one could argue in follicular could be an issue, it seems to be less manifested in mantle cell lymphoma. So I think, again, the cooperative groups are also using a BR backbone for their upfront mantle cell patients in this older patient population.
Now, going back to follicular lymphoma, how has this data set of BR versus R-CHOP affected ongoing trials or trials that are in development?
I think that's a great question, and it's particularly challenging because it's happening at the same time that the PRIMA study is happening. So if you, let's say you had a new drug and you wanted to add it to standard therapy, you'd say, well, okay, I'm going to use R-CHOP or RCVP plus my standard drug in one form or another. Now you have on top of it, well, is now my baseline now BR as opposed to CVPR or CHOP-R? So that's one variable. And then you have the second variable of maintenance rituximab, which is becoming more and more of a standard, and presumably the PRIMA study will encourage this. And so I think those two things happening make everyone ask, okay, so my upfront trial, should I base it on bendamustine? Should I base it on R-CHOP? And do I have to include rituximab maintenance? And I think that's the real issue. It's challenging enough to get studies done, and to throw these variables into it, I think, makes it difficult. Certainly in the cooperative groups, we have a number of studies that are being based on bendamustine. And in fact, in mantle cell lymphoma, all of the cooperative groups are developing upfront for the older patient population bendamustine-based clinical trials. And we are seeing as well bendamustine including trials from a couple of the cooperative groups as initial therapy, whether it's bendamustine rituximab with bortezomib, bendamustine rituximab plus lenalidomide, with or without maintenance. We're seeing more and more of that. So I think it is creeping in, and I think the challenge is going to be at the end of the day, what is the quote-unquote standard that we can work from to build upon, and how do we compare these different regimens? So it does make it difficult.
Can you talk about what we know from the press release on the so-called PRIMA study in patients with follicular lymphoma looking at R maintenance?
The PRIMA study was a study done primarily in Europe, which looked at patients with follicular lymphoma getting an induction therapy with chemotherapy plus rituximab, and then asked the question after that combination, does additional maintenance rituximab provide benefit? And the primary endpoint there is progression-free survival. And so this was a large international study, over 1,000 patients. And the bottom line is what the press release that you alluded to showed or reported, that there is a progression-free survival benefit to the addition of maintenance rituximab after R-chemo in follicular lymphoma. And most of these patients, I believe, had R-CHOP. R-CHOP as their initial treatment. So the idea is that after R-CHOP, if you're using R-CHOP for follicular lymphoma up front, that maintenance R could provide at least a PFS benefit. I think that those data have not yet been presented, but I'm anticipating that we will see them at the upcoming ASCO meeting.
Now, with the PRIMA study and other similar trials, the duration of rituximab maintenance was up to 2 years. What do we know about R maintenance beyond 2 years?
I would say that we know very little about it. Some of the studies that are now ongoing are looking at, so for instance, 2 years versus 5 years of maintenance. And as I understand it, that's kind of like the questions that are being looked at in breast cancer, the standard maintenance versus an even more extended maintenance. So I think it's the same sort of story. I think the issues with long-term maintenance beyond cost include the issues of, you know, immunosuppression and infections. And there's no question that there is an increased incidence of cytopenias and infections and immunoglobulin deficiencies in patients getting long-term rituximab maintenance. I think we have good data to show that that does happen. The real question is how clinically significant it is. Is it a big deal for just a small number of patients or the majority of patients? And really, what's the risk-benefit of that? And I think that's a hard thing to get at, and at the end of the day is going to be pretty individualized based on what the patient's individual preferences are and their own individual situation.
Let's talk about your 47-year-old lady.
This is a patient that I thought reflected some of the challenges and the issues we have in dealing with recurrent follicular lymphoma. This is a 47-year-old woman who initially presented with swelling in her leg and adenopathy in her groin. This was biopsied and had a follicular grade 2 histology at diagnosis. So in some ways, she was very similar to the previous case we discussed, stage 2 disease, mainly abdomen, pelvis, groin. She had a PET scan also. She was symptomatic, so watch and wait was really not an option for her because of this leg swelling. And she, on imaging, had a 6-centimeter iliac cluster of nodes. And in this case, it was an SUV of 14. So this is somebody that I was more concerned about a transformation given this higher SUV. We at the time didn't biopsy her because we just decided that we were going to have to do a core needle biopsy. She had had the inguinal biopsy already, but this higher SUV area, at the end of the day, we figured either way we were going to treat her with R-CHOP because of this high SUV and our concern for transformation. So she received 6 cycles of R-CHOP, tolerated it well, had a good partial response by CT, but did have some residual adenopathy present, and the PET scan was negative, and so that was reassuring that she had a good response. Somewhat disappointingly, you'd expect in someone with follicular lymphoma who had the R-CHOP-based regimen and a good response, you'd expect that she could have a long remission, hopefully going out 5 years or more. But disappointingly, she had progression of disease 12 months later with a recurrence of lymphadenopathy in the pelvis, swelling of her leg in her inguinal region. And this time the PET scan showed an SUV of about 11, so also reasonable. We decided to re-biopsy her because, again, of this concern for transformation, even though the SUV was a little more intermediate, the fact that she recurred so quickly made us concerned that this was a fairly resistant lymphoma, given that her duration of response was relatively limited. The biopsy showed recurrent follicular lymphoma, so no evidence of transformation. And so what we were left with was a woman who has basically recurrent follicular lymphoma, symptomatic, pretty well biopsied without evidence of transformation, but at the end of the day, really a 1-year remission to good therapy with R-CHOP, suggesting that this follicular lymphoma, despite the histology, really wasn't behaving itself very well, and that we were going to need to give her something more to try to get her a more durable remission.
Now, did you consider R-maintenance in her?
We did not at the time. I'm not sure at the end of the day that it would have made a huge difference, but we discussed it with her, and I think at the end of the day just decided not to give her maintenance.
Another thing that's been discussed is the issue of radioimmune therapy consolidation. Mm-hmm. In what situations do you do that? Did you think about it in her?
Well, I think that's a very good question. Certainly, the FIT study that's come out that's looked at basically patients receiving induction chemotherapy, most of those patients received just chemotherapy, although somewhere around 20% of them had received R chemotherapy. That study, the FIT study, showed that basically consolidation with ibrutimumab, tioxetan, or Zevalin improved the CRs that were observed, so basically resulted in more CRs, and probably more importantly, resulted in a longer progression-free survival. So I think the idea of consolidation with radioimmunotherapy is one that's an interesting one. I think the criticism or potential criticism of that study is that so few of the patients had rituximab as part of their initial treatment. So it's almost a question of chemo versus chemo plus or followed by rituximab slash RIT. And I think we all know the answer, at least for the rituximab part, is that we know there's a benefit of rituximab. So the question of, you know, if the control group had rituximab with or without maintenance, would the RIT have had the same impact? And that obviously remains an open question. The SWOG-CLGB study is an R-CHOP versus CHOP followed by I-131 tocilizumab or Bexar. I think that's an ongoing study, completed accrual, that will ask the question, is R chemo better than chemo followed by radioimmunotherapy? So,
of course, we won't know whether it's better than our chemo followed by radioimmunotherapy.
Exactly. And so that relates to the idea of, you know, giving cold rituximab before you give radioimmunotherapy. Is that an issue? Does that compete with the radiolabeled antibody, block it out so you don't have such effective dosing? And I think that's an important scientific point that has not been very well evaluated so far, at least in patients.
So what happened with this lady?
So this lady was a tough one because at the end of the day, I was concerned that she was not going to have a long remission with whatever we did. And so we needed to do something different. And as I approach patients that have follicular lymphoma with a relatively short first remission, I think that, you know, you have to go back and say, well, gee, we have to do something different as our second therapy to try to get a more durable response. And in my mind, the main issues or the main possibilities are radioimmunotherapy, which in about a quarter to a third of patients can get fairly durable remissions, or giving her more intensive therapy and going on to autologous stem cell transplant. And autologous stem cell transplant has been shown to give fairly durable remissions as well. So that's kind of how I laid it out to her, and we discussed this. This was somebody who really was not too excited about an autologous stem cell transplant. I mean, she recognized her overall situation, but she runs a business. She has young kids at home. She really was not of a mindset that she was ready to go that far at this point. But she did recognize that depending on how her disease behaved with her next treatment or two, that she may not have any choice. And before long, she may be in a place where she needed an auto transplant. And so what we decided to do was go the radioimmunotherapy route. But the issues with just going ahead and giving her radioimmunotherapy was the fact that, A, she had some leg swelling and was symptomatic, and RIT takes some time to work. So I wanted to give her some treatment first to get her disease down so that at least to relieve her symptoms pretty quickly. B, I like the idea that you brought up earlier, the idea of consolidation. So the idea of giving her some more chemotherapy to debulk her and then to use the RIT as a consolidation, but not as after first-line therapy, but after second-line therapy. And then third, because I was concerned about auto transplant potentially in the future, and the fact that I thought before long we may need to go in that direction, I wanted to get her stem cells collected. And while you can collect stem cells, autologous stem cells, after RIT, I think in somebody like this who your bed is saying, you know, before long I'm really going to need these stem cells, maybe we ought to get these stem cells in the bank, so to speak, in the freezer before we start beating up her marrow with anything. Yes, down the line I probably can collect them after RIT, but since I think I'm going to be there anyway, why don't I just go ahead and get them now? So what we decided to do was to give her RCVP, both to get her, not that we expected that this was going to give her a very long remission, but we thought that this would get her disease down, get her into, you know, something approaching a PR to get her symptoms relieved. This would not be very marrow toxic. We would then go on and collect her stem cells so that we had them in the bank, so to speak. And then we would go on and give her radioimmunotherapy to try to hope we could get lucky with a durable remission. But if we didn't have success there, at least we had the stem cells frozen away so that our plan B, or plan C, I should say, at that point would be to go on to auto transplant. So what we did was give her RCVP for 3 cycles. She had a nice PR to that. We collected her stem cells, but just held them and froze them for future use. Since she was in a PR, her symptoms were relieved, and then we decided to consolidate her with radioimmunotherapy. And we happen to have a protocol open using I-131 tocilizumab or Bexar in combination with bortezomib or Velcade. It's a phase 1 study run by Rebecca Elstrom in our group, the idea being, can the bortezomib be a radiosensitizer? And so she's completed this therapy. She tolerated it very well. Her cytopenias were basically in line with what you'd expect with RIT alone. And clinically, she's responding. She hasn't had follow-up imaging. But I think this is a good case to give you the sense of really what the challenges are in these patients with a short first remission. And it's almost like a chess match where you have to figure out what's the first move, but what's going to be the second and third move down the line, because this game might play out itself pretty quickly, maybe not over decades, but over a couple of years.
Bortezomib is a radiosensitizer. I'm not sure I've heard that one before.
So there's a variety of preclinical. I mean, bortezomib, through its effect on the proteasome, has activity on a number of different pathways, some of which include pathways associated with radiosensitivity, induction of apoptosis, DNA damage, etc. There have been a variety of different preclinical studies with cell lines and models. There have even been some studies in patients looking at external beam radiation and bortezomib. Nothing in the realm of a phase 3 trial demonstrating a clear benefit, but the concept is really, and there have been similar parallel studies looking at ibrutinib, taxotan, Zevalin in combination with bortezomib as well. And those are, you know, obviously phase 1 studies, non-comparative studies, but the concepts make sense. This is obviously an open question that would need a randomized trial to show a clear effect of the proteasome inhibitor in this sort of setting.
It's really fascinating. What's the dose and schedule of the bortezomib you use there with the RAI?
In this schedule, or in this particular protocol, we're giving 4 doses of bortezomib, and it's centered around the radioactive dose. So the patient gets their cold dose. They then get the first dose of bortezomib just prior to the radiolabeled antibody, and then the other 3 doses. So it's basically just 4 doses of bortezomib, 1 pre-dose before the RIT, and then the other 3 after the RIT dose is administered, but around the time the patient still has radioactivity circulating and hasn't yet cleared all the radioactivity after the treatment.
Anything new and exciting in terms of bortezomib and mantle cell research questions that are being asked?
I think the main areas of research in bortezomib, I think, really have been centered largely on combinations with other therapies. I don't know that there's much that we can say at this point as far as subsets of patients, let's say with mantle cell, who respond to bortezomib. At this point, it certainly remains a drug that's approved in relapsed mantle cell lymphoma, has about a 30% response rate with a PFS of about 9 months. Some patients can have more durable responses. I think the biggest issue is combinations, and we're seeing more and more combinations of bortezomib with rituximab in various settings with different chemotherapy drugs. We're also seeing studies of bortezomib, as we mentioned earlier, with radioimmunotherapy, and bortezomib is also being looked at with bendamustine, and there were 2 abstracts presented at ASH, one we participated in, presented by John Friedberg, another more multi-center group, looking at the BVR combination, bendamustine, bortezomib, and rituximab, both in mantle cell and follicular lymphoma, suggesting that this combination is of interest and is well tolerated. Obviously, we'll take randomized trials to show bendamustine, rituximab, with or without bortezomib, to see if the bortezomib adds anything to the bendamustine-based regimen.
A lot of oncologists, you know, naturally, they want to make sense to look at that in a research perspective. What's being looked at in terms of bortezomib being brought into, you know, upfront aggressive therapy like R-hypersevad or CHOP followed by transplant? R-CHOP, I should say.
So the studies looking at bortezomib as part of upfront therapy, I think, are very, very interesting. There are studies in follicular lymphoma. So, for instance, RCVP plus or minus bortezomib that's going on in Canada. There are studies looking at R-CHOP plus or minus bortezomib in follicular lymphoma and in mantle cell, where in those cases, bortezomib is substituting for vincristine as opposed to adding to vincristine. There are a couple of groups, including the ECOG, that have looked at modified hyper-CVAD with bortezomib. MD Anderson and others have looked at the full-dose hyper-CVAD with bortezomib, also in mantle cell lymphoma. And then the studies in large cell lymphoma of the R-CHOP plus bortezomib focusing more on the non-germinal center subtype. So I think there are lots of studies with bortezomib and standard regimens, and I'm gratified to see that they're entering randomized trials, because that's really what it's going to take to show a clear advantage to the addition of bortezomib. But it's certainly a very exciting drug that I think warrants combination studies with various chemotherapeutic regimens.
What about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma? What are some of the research questions being asked right now in terms of upfront therapy, particularly incorporation of novel agents?
So I think there's a lot happening in diffuse large cell lymphoma. I think one of the big areas is the fact that the molecular subtyping level, we've seen the molecular profiling data that have suggested that there are two major subclassifications of large cell lymphoma at the molecular level, the germinal center and the non-germinal center subtype. The non-germinal center subtype has often been called activated B cell subtype. And the latter, the non-germinal center subtype, has been associated with a less favorable outcome. And so much of the work that's going on is really focused on, well, A, is this reproducible? And the answer is yes, these do appear to be two prognostically important subgroups. And then B, what do we do about it? What drugs do we have that we can impact the outcome? One example of looking at this issue is the CLGB study led by Wyndham Wilson, which is a randomized national trial of R-CHOP versus R-EPOC, the infusional R-EPOC regimen. The idea there being to compare the two regimens, but every patient in this large clinical trial is getting molecular profiling to really validate the technique of molecular profiling, correlating it with outcome, and wondering if whether or not one subgroup does better with the R-EPOC and the other subgroup could do better with the R-CHOP as an example.
How's the assay performed?
This is looking at frozen tissue and looking at RNA-based and DNA-based genetic profiling. There's a whole lot of interest in using immunophenotyping as a surrogate for that, and there's some data that you can do that. There's been a lot of work trying to look at paraffin and paraffin tissues as a source for the material for these assays, and those are moving along and probably before long will be reasonably good surrogates for this type of subclassification. I think the other big area that this has led to is, can we figure out which genes are turned on and which genes are turned off in the good and bad lymphomas and treat them accordingly, i.e., one example is the less favorable subtype, the non-germinal center subtype, has been associated with high levels of NF-kappa-B expression. And NF-kappa-B expression has been associated with obviously keeping cells alive, making them resistant to chemotherapy. And as I'm sure many people know, one mechanism of action or one target of bortezomib, the proteasome inhibitor, is NF-kappa-B. And so that led to our group to do a study in large cell lymphoma where we added bortezomib to rituximab CHOP chemotherapy in large cell lymphoma as well as mantle cell lymphoma for a different reason. And it appears that on a small study, sort of basics, that by adding the bortezomib to the R-CHOP regimen, that we may be improving the outcome for the poorer prognosis non-germinal center subtype. Wyndham Wilson has some other data supportive of that as well. That has all led to a prospective study which is taking patients with newly diagnosed diffuse large cell lymphoma who have the non-germinal center subtype, in this case by immunophenotyping, and randomly assigning them to R-CHOP plus or minus bortezomib. So the idea being, is adding bortezomib in this particular subtype improve outcomes? And so I think this is an example, and there are several others. People are looking at drugs like protein kinase C inhibitors. People are looking at novel antibodies and other molecular targets to really ask the question, can we add an agent targeting a molecular subset of large cell lymphoma and demonstrate that in that subset of patients, going after that target results in improved outcome because that target is relevant to that molecular subgroup?
How do patients do in terms of neuropathy when you give them bortezomib on top of vincristine?
So that's a very good and important question. We now have a number of different studies looking at bortezomib in combination with vincristine-containing regimens. At the ASH meeting, the NCI Canada group had looked at RCVP plus bortezomib. The GILAs looked at R-CHOP plus bortezomib. And again, we have looked at this as well as others such as Brad Call has looked at the variations of the hyper-CVAD regimen plus bortezomib. And I think the bottom line is that you can give bortezomib with vincristine, but you have to make some dose modifications. And you can either make the decision that vincristine is not so important and give full doses of the bortezomib with lower doses of vincristine, or as we did in our study and as the Canadian group did, give full doses of the vincristine, but use half doses, either half the actual dose or half the number of injections of bortezomib with the standard dose vincristine in the R-CHOP or RCVP in their case. So you can give it, but I think it's something that you do need to dose modify to a degree. And the data we have suggests that even with a dose modification, that this may be enough to make an impact for patient outcomes.
Another novel agent that's being looked at in a number of lymphomas, including diffuse large cell, is lenalidomide. What do we know about that?
So lenalidomide, I think, is one of the most exciting agents that we've seen in lymphoma. Obviously, people know that it has a defined role in myeloma and in myelodysplastic syndrome. There have been a variety of different studies looking at lenalidomide, and it seems to have activity in virtually all forms of lymphoma that have been looked at. T-cell lymphoma has activity, B-cell lymphoma, whether it's mantle cell, large cell, follicular lymphoma. All of the studies have suggested that there are response rates in the range of 20 to 40%, depending on the particular subtype, the main toxicities being cytopenias that people are used to dealing with in other malignancies. And so lenalidomide, I think, is a very exciting drug. The question will be, where does it fit among all the other therapies that we have? We've seen some studies combining it with rituximab, and in fact, in CLGB, we have a study, a randomized phase 2 study of single-agent lenalidomide or the combination of lenalidomide plus rituximab in recurrent follicular lymphoma. There have been a variety of groups that have looked at rituximab-lenalidomide combinations, whether it be mantle cell or follicular lymphoma, and I think those are very interesting. In large cell lymphoma, lenalidomide also seems to have single-agent activity. There's also several mantle cell studies going on in patients who've had bortezomib before and progressed. There's also a large randomized trial getting underway looking at lenalidomide as a maintenance after R-chemo. And then finally, at the ASH meeting, we saw some data from Tom Witzig and colleagues looking at the combination of lenalidomide plus R-CHOP given concurrently as initial treatment for large cell lymphoma. And so I think this is interesting given the overlapping toxicities. It's an interesting approach that this can be done. And I think ultimately down the line, we will be seeing some concurrent chemo lenalidomide combinations, which I think offers some significant promise.
What about the use of maintenance therapy with any of these novel agents after, say, R-CHOP?
Well, in large cell lymphoma, the only real agent that's been looked at in a maintenance setting has been rituximab. And the data really from the ECOG CLGB study that looked at older patients with large cell lymphoma suggested that if you're giving R-CHOP or R-chemo, that maintenance rituximab in large cell lymphoma doesn't seem to add any value at this point with respect to progression-free or overall survival. In contrast to follicular lymphoma, where the PRIMA study is telling us, at least preliminarily, and we'll see those data as they come out, that R-chemo followed by rituximab, that the maintenance rituximab, even after R-chemo, can potentially add benefit. So far, all of the maintenance studies really have centered around rituximab. I think as we get certainly oral agents and well-tolerated agents that one can use as maintenance, we're going to be seeing more and more of that. That's being looked at primarily, I think, with lenalidomide so far. And I think some of the other agents that are coming along as they demonstrate single agent activity and equally importantly, tolerability, because to be on a maintenance for a year or two, if you feel miserable, it's really got to work well. So for a drug to be used in a maintenance setting really has to, I think, have an impact, but also be quite tolerable for patients with respect to their quality of life.
One more question about diffuse large B-cell. You mentioned the work that's been done at your place in this study looking at PET scanning. What are you looking at, and what do you think is a reasonable, approach outside of a protocol setting?
So I think the issue of PET scanning is complicated. There is no doubt that in initial staging of patients that a PET scan can be helpful in aggressive lymphoma in particular or Hodgkin's lymphoma. So in diffuse large cell lymphoma, I think a PET scan is standard of care. I think at the end of treatment, documenting a remission with PET scan is also very well established. A patient that achieves a PET scan negativity is associated with a relatively more favorable outcome. Someone who does not achieve PET scan negativity in large cell lymphoma either should be biopsied at these sites or followed very closely and ultimately biopsied because those patients are at a greater risk of relapse. So at the beginning of treatment, at the end of treatment, we know pretty well that PET scans have a well-defined role. I think the questions remain largely in two areas. One is, how do you follow patients? Once somebody's in remission, there's no real standard as to how often do you see the patient, how often do you do a scan, what type of scan do you follow patients who are in remission from large cell lymphoma over the next several years with scanning every 3 months, every 4 months, every 6 months, once a year. Which scan do you do? Do you do any scans? There's really a paucity of data, and as patients get more and more concerned about radiation exposure and toxicity, as well as we get concerned about cost, all of these, I think, raise a number of significant questions. There are certainly guidelines from the NCCN that suggest that periodic imaging, largely with CAT scans, is their standard, but I think one could certainly question that, and there are certainly plenty prominent friends of mine who work in lymphoma who basically say, once I see a negative scan, I don't continue to scan patients because most relapses present clinically as opposed to an asymptomatic finding on a scan. I would say the other issue that you alluded to was the interim PET scanning, the idea that a patient in the middle of therapy has a scan. If that shows negativity, meaning no more uptake, or positivity, meaning persistent uptake, what do you do with that information? I think one of the challenges is the fact that there is a huge amount of inter-observer or inter-reader variability. And in fact, Sandra Horning has presented some data suggesting that some of the ECOG experts differed as much as a third of the time on whether a scan was really positive or negative. So if that holds, and your and my radiologists are, you know, equally good or probably less good, how reliable are their scans in really calling somebody positive or negative? And then the second thing is, well, what do you do about it? And I think where we are right now is that for interim scans, that's really a subject of clinical trials. Can we reliably look at a population of patients, determine who's got an interim positive or negative PET scan? And then the question is, well, do we do something about that? Do we just continue therapy as we planned, even though we've got a positive scan? Or can we start to do something differently, i.e. take a patient who has a persistent positive scan and treat them more aggressively or with a different regimen, or somebody who has a negative scan early and treat them with less therapy because that's someone who's likely to do well. And so I think in practice outside of a study, the answer should really be to minimize your interim PET scanning and really not act on it unless you're doing a biopsy, because you can be led astray and have both false positive and false negative results.